Welcome to the World of Women Create podcast series, where we bring you the magical and innovative worlds of artisans and makers from the pages of our magazines, Where Women Create and What Women Create, along with special guests who are entrepreneurs and experts in their fields. We love to share great conversation with extraordinary women, women you may be very familiar with and others you may not know. My name is Jennifer Blott, and I am the editor-in-chief of Women Create. It is my pleasure to welcome you, our listeners, and all of our guests as we explore the ups and downs, challenges and triumphs, exhilaration and immense joy of living a creative life. A creative life is a life that's rarely stagnant and always leading us down surprising paths. Thank you for being part of our creative world, the world of Women Create. Hello and welcome. I'm here today with Isabel Fish, the founder of The Club by Rue Pigalle, a travel club for women patrons of craft. Isabel was born in the French Alps and grew up in a family that revered the handmade and furnished their home with antiques and family heirlooms, and no holiday was complete without visiting local maker studios. It was at law school that she met her South African husband, whose career took them around the world. Finally settling in Canada and having decided that, after all, law was not her life calling, Isabel launched Rue Pigalle Artisanal Journeys, women-only trips to France, the UK, and South Africa, connecting her guests to the world of craft. And this is only part of Isabel's story, and we are so thrilled to be with you today, Isabel. Welcome.
Hello, Jennifer. Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yes, and the one thing I didn't say at the onset is that your story is in our current summer issue of Where Women Create, where you give your first person creative journey and talk a little bit more about how Rue Pigalle came about. First of all, why don't you tell people where you came up with the name Rue Pigalle?
It's a question I'm often asked. And if I had more of a writing brain, I would have probably changed a different name. But Rue Pigalle actually started as a gallery of contemporary jewelry. I'm French and I like to adorn myself. I'm a little vain. And, Rue Pigalle is the red light district in Paris, was the red light district in Paris. It's that secret place that people don't dare to go, but they can't resist. It's just like, you know, jewelry and these things that you know that you can't treat yourself to, but you want to. So there was that air of a little mystery, a little, I want to treat myself to something special. I want to look after myself. I want to create a dialogue with others through what I'm wearing and all things that are very French. So, and I wanted to have a French name because that's where I grew up and I'm still very attached to the country.
So I love the fact that you started out wanting to be a lawyer, going into law. I actually had a job early on working for a legal journal. And many of the stories I wrote were about people who had law degrees who went on to do much more creative things. And so tell me, let's start your story with when you arrived in Toronto and how the gallery boutique came about and then evolved. And then I know some changes happened during the pandemic for you as well.
I loved practicing law. And I think that you find a lot of lawyers in creative fields because to be a good lawyer, you have to be able to think outside the box. You have to be creative. So there's a natural connection there. When we arrived in Canada, I was not qualified here. And it was one of these life's gifts and opportunities that you seize. And I always wanted to do something, about métier d'art, about know-how, about craft, about the skills. And I seized that opportunity. I wasn't sure exactly how to do it. So it seemed that doing a boutique was the most natural way to get into that field. I also needed to build a community in Canada. And really the boutique gave me that opportunity to connect with women who, 14 years later, are still my friends, are still my clients, have followed me from moving from the boutique to the artisanal journeys. It's been really an extraordinary opportunity and obviously a life-changing decision.
And wasn't one of the reasons you created the boutique is you wanted to offer the types of things that you couldn't find there when you arrived, the sorts of things that you wanted to buy?
That's correct. And it was very much a cultural reason behind that. I think that French culture is much more ornate, whether it's in your home or in what you wear or things you do and how you do them. And I wanted to bring that cultural difference. I wanted to bring that joie de vivre and that color and a bit of exuberance to women in Canada. So it was a way also for me to build a cultural bridge. And I was representing and selling makers that nobody else had in Canada, mostly French, but also, you know, a bit from all over. The common criteria was that first, I had to love it. Second, it had to surprise me. Third, I had to build a good rapport with the designer and the maker, because when you bring a product to a market where it's totally unknown, you have to share your passion for it. You have to build the market for it. And it's extremely difficult to build a market when you don't have that emotional rapport with the maker. And that was really the whole business premise. And I think that the clients really got into it. They were fascinated by these people that they had never met, by the objects I was bringing that were extremely different from anything. And that was the beginning of the adventure.
Now, how did that transition to the journeys and the club part of Rupigal? How did that all come about? And what was the timeline?
Yeah, so the boutique was open for 7 years, and retail is an activity for young people. You know, I was already in my 50s when I started the boutique, and after 7 years, there was I had to renew my lease. We had a change of lifestyle in our family, and I was physically tired. And I thought, you know, maybe it's time to do something else. But the client said, well, what are we going to do now? What is it? And I said, well, I don't know. Go live your life. Go find something else.
But they were attached to you and your vision. Clearly. Yeah.
They were very attached to me. And they are the one who suggested, you know, why don't you take us traveling? Why don't you take us to meet these makers and let's do this? So I thought, oh, that's a brilliant idea. I love traveling. I love sharing my culture. So I did the first trip in 2018. I selected 12 women that I knew well. And I knew that, you know, they would be forgiving if I didn't get everything right. I had no idea what I was doing. And it was fantastic success. So then I tried a couple of other things. And by 2020, we were, in full flight of a new business. I had 4 trips sold out, which represents 40 clients. And the pandemic happened. And in a second, the business disappeared, because we had to cancel everything. We had to refund everybody. It was a little daunting, I have to say. When it became very clear that this was going to be more than the few weeks or the few months we thought, I had to completely rethink the business. And we went online. At the time, I had a fantastic marketing assistant, colleague, who said, you got to go online and let's do these Zoom interviews. So we started in March 2020, so very quickly, doing weekly live interviews of makers and artists in their studios around the world. And for a year, every Wednesday at 1 p.m., people knew that they could log on and there was someone fascinating to discover. And from there, we produced the blog, and we were doing all sorts of video contents. We even did live Zoom travel. We did a 5-day trip to Italy. So for 5 days, for 3 hours a day, we went to Venice, we went to Milan, we went to Verona. We had galleries welcoming us. We had makers. We went to the glassblowers studios of Venice because they had not shut down. They couldn't. It was wild.
Okay. I'm trying to picture this. So you did essentially you coordinated with them in a different time zone, and they logged on from where they were and sort of took people through their spaces and talked to them That's and right. answered questions. Okay.
That's right. Wow. That's right. It was really incredible. We even, you know, found someone who gave us a boat ride live on Zoom from Murano to San Marco Plaza. And gave us a commentary. She was a historian. And so we did things like that. And it was important for us to stay in front of our customers. But what I quickly realized was how important it was for the mostly women who were logging on and who were starting to recognize each other on screen, because I didn't do a webinar style. The audience could see each other and interact with each other. Yeah. And that community grew. And that's when I suddenly realized, there's a need and a desire for connection among women 55 and up. We had very few younger women because they were so busy working and having the kids at home and all that juggling. They had no time to log on to our calls. Yeah. But the women of my generation were at home and isolated and relished this weekly connection. So I launched the club more as a community service, quote unquote, I would say, as a way to bring people together and give them connections to each other. And as we came out of the pandemic, they stayed. We saw the membership changed because at the beginning, it didn't matter where you lived, you could be a member. As we were doing more in-person events, I live in Toronto, the membership became more local. But now we are seeing members who are joining from outside Toronto because they want to come on the trips, because they love the online program and the resources we offer. And also because they are connecting with each other. And when they travel, the members go and visit each other. So we're starting to see friendship developing across borders. So it's a wild adventure, I have to say. but it's a beautiful adventure of friendship and connections, of learning. I did a local event 2 days ago, and as it always happens, two women who had not seen each other in years suddenly find each other at the same event. Mm-hmm. So it's been very much the impetus of this club.
So tell me about some of your local events. What sort of activities do you travel around the Toronto area? What happens at those local events?
So once a month, we get together either at a studio or at a gallery, a museum, at a place that is craft related. And it's a way to learn. The artists welcome us. And then we go for dinner. So it's a mix of learning, discovering, supporting local businesses, and again, nurturing these connections, these friendships. That's what happens every month. And it's part of the membership. All the members are welcome, and it's free to the members. Then we have day trips, which is what I did 2 days ago. So, for most of the day, we went to three studios where I had organized visits. The theme was ceramics, but in there we also slotted in a forge because the ceramic artists we were visiting had transitioned to metal. Mm. And, sometimes I put a workshop in the middle of the day. So we'll do maybe ceramic, or we'll do stitching, or we'll do, other activities. So that's the second type of activities. And then the third type of activities is the workshops. And those are both in-person and online. We do a lot of online workshops because then online, people say they are tired of online, but I think they're starting to realize now that it really allows us to access places, people, talents that otherwise we wouldn't. So for example, in November, we have a passementerie workshop with an artist. Passementerie is an endangered craft in the UK. And she's going to do a 4-hour workshop for us, by the end of which we will have made a beautiful rosette that we can put, you know, on a curtain or on a sofa. And it also, this online access allows us to invite women from all over the world. So the only limitation is time difference. But the last workshop we did, we had someone from Singapore, and you know, she was happy to get up in the middle of the night to do the workshop, which was a great compliment.
So you have multiple events going on through the club. How many of the international trips do you take each year?
We do about 4 a year, which, and they vary. I try to, so I believe that you cannot be an expert at everything. So I specialize in France, UK, and South Africa, because this is where I have my deepest network. I also take great pride in taking my clients to places I have visited, I have checked, I have vetted, and, you know, I have a family. I can't, as much as I would love to, I can't spend my time traveling to check things. We branch out from time to time to different places. So in October, we're going to Norway. And that's going to be a great trip. We have access to some exclusive places, such as a brand new museum that's opening, I think, next week, and hosting a private collection. And we will meet the collector who's donated his collection. So a trip like that would be a 12-day trip. But a trip to, you know, for example, we were in London in March. It was only 6 days, and it's very different vibes. We try to mix and match. Not everybody can take 12 days and go gallivanting across the world. And we usually offer our trips to women only. I'm always asked, why women? At the beginning, it was mostly because it's easier to organize a trip for someone, you know, for one gender. But again, the magic that happens on these trips among the women who become friends, sometimes just for a trip, sometimes the friendship carries on, has really, it has nurtured me, it has encouraged me, but I think that it has really served a purpose and has been important to these women. And the trips are very much about discovering a place through its craft.
So it's women only on the trips. Are most of the maker studios you visit studios of women artisans or women and men?
They are women and men, because I think that what is important is to understand the skills and the craft. And one of my mission is to educate people about the importance of skills, particularly in North America, where a lot of the craft don't exist. It's just a historical context. So it's important that people understand, discover new things so they can support them, and that these crafts can remain alive and can evolve in a contemporary setting. Otherwise, we are losing our heritage. And, you know, as we know, when you start losing your heritage, then the community that you're living in is starting to dissolve and disintegrate. So we choose the studios we visit based on skills, more than gender. And we also select them that the when we do workshops, that we can finish something and we can take it home. So it's another way to really create a long-term relationship between the maker and the guest. It's very much about enlarging that community and that ecosystem of craft and making it a long-term relationship between the guest and the maker and the craft and the place.
Well, I know that you visit some extraordinary studios of extraordinary women because you have curated a few stories for us and will curate a few more. Women that you have met in your travels who do extraordinary things. So thank you. Thank you for introducing our readership to some of these makers in other countries, people we maybe would never ever meet. You know.
Well, I have to say that I have enormous pleasure in connecting people. and enormous pleasure in sharing the work of these women who are truly extraordinary. I mean, so many are, you know, I mean, there's the hours, the thousands of hours spent to acquire a skill to the highest level. But there's also the sheer dedication. Their entire life is dedicated to their craft, to their art. And it has consequences for that. They don't necessarily choose the easy path because they want to remain true to their craft and their passion. And they are extremely dedicated to passing it on and to supporting it. So I really think that we are so much richer when we meet people like that, when we learn from them. We always go home with lots to think about and to bring into our life and enrich ourselves. And then we talk about them and we enrich our own circle of friends and our children and our, you know, the people we live and surround ourselves with. The snowball effect is quite extraordinary. So, and I mean, your platform is amazing. You are telling all these stories. And I think, you know, I've been blown away by the article for a start that you did on us.
Was your story, though. You wrote it. It was right. Your first person's story. And it came together beautifully.
But I think that you really are supporting these women. It's important to artists to share their stories. And that was a real issue during the pandemic, is that they could not connect with their audience. And it wasn't just an economic hardship. It was an inspiration struggle. Artists need to connect with their audience and to share their love. It nourishes them, it nurtures them in their journey to create something else. And few people understand that, but it's really important.
So you call yourself a craft ambassador. Tell me what that means. I love this title. Just give me a synopsis of what that means to you and what it means to own that title.
So it's a self awarded title. I really feel that my way to give back and to pay it forward is to do what I do, is to talk about the values of craft. It's to share the message, it's to give a voice to artists and makers who either don't know how or don't have the time or the resources to share that message. But it's also about bringing enrichment to the audience and giving them a chance to bring something different in their life, to enrich it, to discover. You know, we talk a lot about diversity at the moment, but few of us know how to access it. And I think that's what I'm trying to do. It's bring diversity and enrichment in my audience life. I also believe that it's important to support craft education, because if people don't know how to make things, then the craft will disappear. I don't know how it is in the States, but in Canada and in France and in the UK, manual skills and craft and art education is not funded adequately by governments. So, you know, I support these programs, and we actually created a new program in partnership with the local Arts Council, where we have started educational program to teach students age 13 to 16 craft skills. The basics are ceramic, glass, and wood. And we raised the funds for that program to make it accessible to everybody, and nobody's turned away if they can't afford it. So the members of the club and our community is funding that initiative. The initiative has just finished its first school year. It's taught by professional makers who are remunerated. It's very important that the economic cycle is full. And we really want to show teenagers, students, that craft can be a career, that you can live off it, that it's fulfilling, and that, you know, there's an economic possibility there.
And do these classes take place after school?
So they take place after school. They are at the moment we're doing it locally in a rural area where there is no access easily to this kind of teaching. And we want the program to be over 3 years to be able to not only develop the manual skills, but also business management skills. And we have 8 students per class at the moment. So we are modest, but the idea would be very much to make this model, you know, being replicated in other areas, whether urban or rural. Canada is a vast country. There's a lot of areas where there's no access to that kind of teaching, and that would be an ideal model to do that.
That's wonderful. And you've talked about all of these different things that you do. Do you have a team? Do you have people helping you? Are you doing this all yourself?
So I do have a team, actually. I have a part-time team. Marion is in France, and she does the logistics and the tech and helps me with the logistics of the events and the trips. And Lucy is in the UK. Lucy is an art historian and an amazing writer. So she helps with creating the content for the events and does all the research for the trip. So I couldn't do it just by myself. And then in the club, we have members who are very active participants and who are actually running some of the activities. We have a member who runs the Literary Conversation Program, which is an online program that takes place in the winter month, because summers are short in Canada and people want to be outdoors. And we have another member who runs the stitching group, which is all about textile, whether you are a maker or a lover. So the community is very active and self-supporting, and I couldn't do it all by myself. No, nobody can.
No, it's even with 2 part-time people helping you, it still sounds like a lot of work. So one thing, we've talked about your dedication to craft. Do you do any making or creating yourself?
You know, I am blessed with 10 thumbs. So I don't. I dabble. I do a little pottery. I do a little sewing, a little woodwork, but I don't have much time for it, unfortunately. You know, it's really true. People talk about the flow, and you might find it yourself. When you need inspiration, you need time, you need quiet, and you need to be able to open your mind, your heart, your soul to whatever idea comes. That's what artists do. And I don't really have the time to do that. But I have a very sharp eye, so I can detect.
You're a good curator.
Things, yes.
So I'd love to hear some of the things you hear from women who've been on the international trips. What sort of things do they tell you at the end of the journey? How has it changed their perspective?
You know, the most beautiful emotion that someone shared with me was awe. She said, I just came back with awe in my soul, in my heart, for what we saw, the people we met. And I think, again, it's that makers are capable of doing things bigger than themselves. Very few of us can do that. You know, we're so wrapped up in our daily life that it takes a lot of vision and courage to do something bigger than yourself. But makers do, and they have that long-term vision, and they have that absolute sheer dedication to it. And when you come across that, you are humbled and you are in awe. So that sense of being marvelous, I don't know what the emotion is, émerveillé is the French word I'm thinking of, but wonder. And the second emotion is that sense of community and friendship. So the groups are kept to 10 guests maximum. So I can give it personal attention to everybody, but also people can connect with each other without being lost in a huge group. We've even done trips with only 4 guests. Economically, it's not my my preferred model, But it made for fantastic girls' trips experiences, and these friendships carry on, and they really nurture you. I think that as women, when we come up for air in our late 50s, the kids are taken care of, our career, you know, is done. And even if we're not thinking yet of retiring, it's established, it doesn't require as much work. We have a partner who doesn't need us really, and is busy in whatever he or she is doing. And we come up for air and we suddenly realize that we haven't had time to nurture our friendships or make new friendships. We haven't had time to cultivate new interests, and we are a little lost. I found that myself, and I'm hearing that from the women members and the women I come across, and they say, you know, I feel untethered, and the club gives them that kind of sense of belonging and home and community. Okay, this is a place where I can meet women, where I can do different things, where I can explore. Time-wise, it's not demanding at all. You can use it or be involved as much or as little as you want, but it's there. And it's always there for you with all the flexibility that you want to put in your life and use it for. And I think that that sense of community, that sense of being anchored is very important. And then, you know, sometimes life change and you move on. It's not a commitment for life, but it's there and you can always come back.
And I'm guessing that your membership is probably a mixture of people who are artists and makers and those who are just appreciating being around that and absorbing other people's skills and their craft.
Yes, that's correct. And I'm really honored that makers and artists want to be members and are members, because it's a real badge of approval for the quality of what we're doing. Again, the exchange we have with them and the exchange they have with us as non-artists is so enriching for everybody and so wonderful. So I always love when makers want to become members. It's a yes, instant yes.
So in your story, you mentioned the importance of choosing a business model that suits your personality. Tell me what you meant by that.
I think that if you come to business the way I did, without a business education or a background, you need to do something. And unless you have huge capital and your vision is to build an empire, you need to have a business that fits with your life, because otherwise you're going to resent it. You're not going to have enough time for it, and you're not going to find the rewards that you deserve when you work so hard. So that's the first thing. And it needs to fit your personality, because very often it's a labor of love. If you don't like people, don't open a store. Kind of thing, because you'll be miserable and you won't be successful. So I think if you start your life as a, you know, as an entrepreneur and a business person, and you have that vision to grow something, and it doesn't matter what it is that you do or sell, you can be selling widgets, it doesn't matter for you, it's all about the business, then, you know, that's great. But if you need to, if you have an emotional involvement in that business, then make sure that it fits your personality and your lifestyle, because otherwise you just won't succeed.
That's great advice. So do you ever get approached by artists in other countries who invite you to bring your groups to visit them? Or do you do most of the work on your end trying to find them?
I do a lot of research, that's for sure. I spend 2-3 hours a day doing research. I think I have about 12 magazine subscriptions. I receive newsletters and all that. But I'm very blessed that the word of mouth among the artist community is going around, and I have people a lot every day. I have someone who approaches me and says, oh, I hear you're coming here, or I would love to show you my work, or this is my project, would you mind sharing it? And I would love if you were to visit us. my relationship with the artists, with some of them, and it's I'm very humbled by that, is a bit as a mentor or as a sounding board, because being an artist is a very solitary profession, because you need to have that quiet to be able to open yourself to the flow and the inspiration. But at the same time, you need a community, because, you know, this is how human beings are. And it's difficult for them to find that. So I often have long conversations and Zoom coffees, I'll call them, with artists, and we exchange and they tell me the ideas. And I share some experience or concept or ideas, and or I connect them to someone. And so my relationship with the creative community is very tender, I would say. We look after each other. We respect each other. We exchange ideas. And there's always someone new to discover. But it's nice to know that people have heard about you and invite you in.
Well, and they open their studios, they give their time, they share their wisdom. But you also, when you bring people into their studios, you often bring them patrons, people who buy their work, correct?
That's correct. So that's the philanthropic side of Rupigal, of my approach. I do bring the patrons to the studios, and there's always at least one person who buys. I don't take commission on these sales at all. And I do that for two reasons. One, because I consider that I had nothing to do with how this beautiful object was made. So why would I take a credit for it? I am paid by the client for my services through selling the trip. And also it gives me independence. The clients know that if I bring them to a studio, it's because I respect it and its quality. That patronage is important. It is the way that we can support the makers, you know, to pay their rent. The other thing is, some artists need, you know, more income. And as you said, it takes time to get the studio ready and to welcome us. Some artists charge a fee, and I always pay that fee. I actually often ask people if they do charge a fee. And I would say that the last thing is that my clients are not allowed to ask for discount or to bargain down the price. I encourage also the artists and the makers not to offer discounts, because I think that they need to believe in their price. If the price is fair, then that's the price that the client needs to pay. I always say, when we go to the butcher and we buy a piece of meat, we don't bargain down if we buy 1.5 kilo instead of 1 kilo, you know? And but for some reason, people think that in art and craft, you should do that. And it's the most bizarre thing. So we don't allow that at Rupigal on our trips.
I really appreciate that. As it is, many, many artists do not charge an amount that's reflective of all the work that goes into what they create. We've had many stories from artists who have a very hard time pricing. They underprice things. So I love that respect from the people who are visiting.
It's a really complex issue, because we live in a economic model where time is, skills is charged by the hour. Yes, you have a bit of material, and when you are a jeweler, you have the price of the stone and the gold and all that, and that is very much that. But when you do ceramic or paper art, you know, the cost of your material is very low. So what you charge is the time, and the time is hundreds of hours. How do you charge for that? So that's one issue. The other issue is that because of this lack of education of manual skills that I mentioned earlier, we don't understand, we don't have the knowledge anymore on how things are made. And therefore, as consumers, when we look at an object, we have no point of reference to appreciate the number of hours and the effort and the skills that are in there and value that. For the artist, it's a really complicated model. The other thing is galleries don't buy. A lot of galleries take things on consignment and put the financial pressure on the artist and the maker to bear the cost of producing the piece. Yes, the gallery will do the marketing, and yes, they have a lease, but everybody does. That's a business model. And yet they do not take this art on their books, in their inventory. And if it doesn't sell, they send it back to the artist. It's got to be the only economic sector where that happens. I don't know. I don't know anybody else who says, well, you know, yes, I will make you try to sell, but if you can't sell it, just give it back to me. And I mean, it's bizarre. So it makes life extremely difficult for the artist. Yes.
So we're almost halfway through the year. I know you have Norway coming up. Anything else we should be out on the lookout for?
Oh, yes, we have a lot happening. We are going to Nova Scotia in September. In 2 weeks' time, we'll be in France. So doing a trip to the Southwest, and I'll be always document the trips on Instagram. People can travel with us. Then it's Nova Scotia in September, Norway in October, and we're going to the UK in November. And I'm really looking forward to that trip. It's going to be a trip with a bit of a difference. In November in London, it's open studio season. So you have access to even more special studios than the rest of the year. But also, I was very inspired in January. I was in India and spent 3 weeks there scouting and traveling around. And from there, I went to the UK and I suddenly realized that the influence of Indian craft and Indian aesthetic on British decorative art is huge in architecture, in ceramics and all that. So the trip to London and Manchester in November will take us to places where we can see that influence of Indian craft and aesthetic on British decorative arts. We have access to some extraordinary studios of Indian makers or makers of Indian descent. We're going to visit some private collections and some other secret places that...
Oh, it sounds wonderful.
Yes. And then next year, we have a trip planned to Alsace in France, in the east of France, which is an area with a richness in craft that is astonishing. And it's all on the website.
And we will be listing all of that. I wish I could go with you on every single one of those trips. Oh, I will somehow be living vicariously through you. And fortunately, through your upcoming stories that you're curating, we will get to meet some of these makers.
It will. I'm really, really so happy that we'll be able to share their stories with you and with your readers. It's a great privilege. Thank you so much for giving that opportunity.
Well, thank you. And thank you for joining us today. It's been wonderful. Your passion for craft, your passion for travel, for exploration, for supporting the arts. It's so apparent and so wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure. Thank you so very much for your support. I really appreciate it.
Thank you again for joining us today for our World of Women Create podcast. In a world filled with endless stories, it is our mission to share the memorable personal journeys and lessons learned of the extraordinary women in our community. Their stories are stories that enlighten us, inform us, and ignite the creativity that lives in each of us. Women Create is grateful that you are part of our creative world.